AOL Radio here. Thanks for tuning in. Sorry about the crossover in audio. I had meant to be back here by the start of my show so I could turn off the Revolutionary Ecology, the audio on Judy Berry. But I didn't get back here on time. I was sidetracked by the bridge opening, or the underpass opening at King Street in Kitchener. Just biked over there on my way over to the radio station, checked it out. Apparently it's supposed to be open at noon. It's still not really open yet, and everybody's patting each other on the back and giving high fives, and the politicians are arriving, and everyone's having such a great time. There's no bike lanes, and King Street itself, with the tracks on it and how they've crossed the street and the tracks and merged them together, it's dangerous to bike. The tracks cross the road and you're almost riding parallel with the tracks. People are going to fall in and break themselves unless they have some other idea on bike lanes. But nothing's painted in terms of bike lanes. It's as if there isn't an actual commitment to safe bike infrastructure and non-vehicular infrastructure in the city. Like they designed things in a way that people are going to get hurt. Designed it in a way that maybe we'll put bike lanes over here and people will stay over there. Well, what if they don't? They're going to get hurt. Very, very much a Vision Zero fail. If you're not familiar with the Vision Zero Keeping People Safe movement, check it out online, Vision Zero, hashtag, and all that. In Kitchener-Waterloo, they suffer from a actual lack of commitment to safe streets in Kitchener-Waterloo. I got to say it. And I got to say it because we'd have safe streets in Kitchener-Waterloo if people, if politicians in the city were actually committed to it. Like they're committed to the PR circus that's going down right now. AWOL Radio with you. And that's my story of why I was late. It's true, I promise. I'm going to read some disappointing news and then play an interview, somewhat related interview. So this piece from ChippewaSolidarity.org. Supreme Court redefines Indigenous consultation in inconsistent rulings. Chippewas of the Thames First Nation continues to oppose tar sands pipeline forced through their community as the Supreme Court of Canada equates Indigenous consultation with participation in a public hearing. Meanwhile, Clyde River Inuit celebrate victory over seismic blasting permit. On the morning of Wednesday, July 26th, the Supreme Court ruled against the Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, stating that indirect federal consultation via the National Energy Board's standard public hearings discharged Canada's duty to consult, rather than direct nation-to-nation engagement. In a linked ruling, the court quashed a blasting exploration permit approved by the NEB after agreeing that the NEB did not even attempt to properly consult the Clyde River Inuit on the project. Newly elected chief of the Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, Myungin Henry, stated, quote, "We're extremely disappointed that the court wasn't able to uphold our rights, but when you fight for your rights, that's something to be proud of. There's more work to do, and we're going to continue to do it." Chippewas of the Thames First Nations case centered on Enbridge's Line 9 pipeline project, which has been vigorously opposed by communities all along its path. Line 9, now more than 40 years old, runs from Sarnia to Montreal, crossing through Chippewas of the Thames First Nations territory and that of many other Indigenous communities. Even though Chippewas of the Thames First Nation repeatedly objected that they had not been consulted, Enbridge was given the green light by the National Energy Board to start pumping tar sands bitumen and fracked oil through the pipeline in December 2015. Chippewas of the Thames First Nation's case was heard by the Supreme Court in November 2016. Despite the ruling, Chippewas of the Thames First Nation continues to stand against Enbridge's Line 9 pipeline. After the ruling, the community gathered at the Deshkanzibi, the Thames or Antler River, while Myungin Henry read a statement outlining their opposition to Line 9, which bisects the entire watershed and crosses the Deshkan and at least six major tributaries of the river. Chief Myungin Henry demanded that Enbridge, quote, "cease operating tar sands pipelines through Chippewas of the Thames First Nations territory," unquote, warning that the company had, quote, 30 days to comply, unquote. Outgoing Chief Leslie Whiteye remarked, quote, "they don't understand us, and they don't have structures in place to understand us, and they don't seem to want to dismantle it." There are nations across Turtle Island that are going to see this decision in the same way, and we hope they will join us in this struggle and to protect the well-being of the land and our communities in relation to creation, unquote. White Eye concluded, quote, "This decision has strengthened our resolve. Canada has a fight ahead," unquote. Similarly to Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, Clyde River Inuit's case insisted that National Energy Board hearings did not amount to consultation. Their case concerned seismic blast testing in the waters near their community, which was approved by the National Energy Board despite the lack of proper consultation. This ruling comes amidst a growing wave of resistance to Canada's handling of the issues pertaining to Indigenous communities, including the Commission on Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls and the youth suicide crisis in Northern Ontario communities. White Eye and Henry expressed, Henry stating, quote, "As long as the Indian Act is in place, their judgment will always be tainted," unquote. While White Eye observed the apparent lack of respect for nation-to-nation relationships in the Supreme Court ruling, stating, quote, "We are nations and we deserve that much respect," unquote. And that was a piece from ChippewaSolidarity.org, the press release following the ruling on Wednesday this week, where the Supreme Court, in a baffling move, approved the appeal of Clyde River Inuit and then dismissed the appeal of Chippewas of the Thames First Nation and awarded Enbridge costs. In the Clyde River case, the Supreme Court decided and ruled that the NEB didn't even really try to undertake a proper consultation process, completely negligent of their responsibilities. And then in the Chippewas of the Thames ruling, the Supreme Court said that the NEB is a reliable body that can undertake these consultations. But in the linked ruling, they said the NEB was basically like didn't even try, and showing that they don't really have the skills and the expertise to undertake consultation, let alone the mandate. But yeah, the Supreme Court ruling is shocking in its absurdity. Or I know the lawyer for Chippewas of the Thames First Nation expressed that he couldn't really understand how this ruling works yet after his first reading. And so this might have, I mean, it sets a horrible precedent. Basically, it's the NEB. If you're told about an NEB hearing, then that's going to amount to consultation. Is what it whittles down to. Whether you take part in that in the public hearing process or not. And it's not consultation. They don't have experts in consultation whatsoever. They have industry experts, or at least the ones in the Line 9 hearing and most of the hearings that I've seen. This is it's shocking that they how they ruled. It's not shocking that they ruled against the Chippewas of the Thames and against Indigenous rights. It's shocking that they ruled in this split way, saying, and it's an amazing victory for Clyde River Inuit. The seismic blasting would have decimated the local wildlife in the water, completely killing the plankton, killing the whales, killing the krill, killing everything in between, to look for more oil so we can continue to pump more CO2 and methane into the atmosphere so we can cook the planet even faster. It's and of course that wasn't we didn't talk about that in the hearings because they weren't allowed to because the scope of them is so small. And there's this panel recently, Trudeau put a panel together and saying the NEB should be dismantled and completely changed. And then the Supreme Court comes out saying no, they should be given the duty of and the power to consult with on a nation-to-nation basis. These appointed industry people. Given the duty to consult on a nation-to-nation level from Canada, that's the level they wrote about reconciliation in the Supreme Court ruling, but they and unironically used it, talking like putting it in a business case about reconciliation and saying how there's no veto power but there was no consultation process. The government admitted that, and the Supreme Court even wrote that. Notwithstanding the fact that the government only told Chippewas of the Thames First Nation that it was a consultation process after the process happened, notwithstanding that, Chippewas of the time should have known, and that this was manifestly adequate, was their language. Manifestly adequate. Clearly adequate. Well, it clearly wasn't adequate, or clearly adequate, if it had to go to the Supreme Court for a decision to be made about it. Like, really. If it was really clear, it would have been, no, this is clear, sorry, we're not going to listen to this case. Supreme, wow, of course it's the colonial court system, and of course they're going to collude with the political system and the capitalist resource-based system, resource exploitation economy that we have in this country. Of course they're going to continue to oppress indigenous people while maintaining their power. Of course they're going to do that. So it's not shocking in that the decision went against, because that's what, you know, colonizers are going to colonize, but it's shocking that they split this decision in such a way. Because if the NEB is incompetent in one case that happened at the same time, how can they be competent in another case? And the one thing, all three of the panel members that were ejected from the TransCanada Energy East pipeline hearings a while ago under corruption, improper behaviors, they, all three of them sat separately. Two of them were on one board, the other on the other one, for the Clyde River and the Line 9 cases. And these are the people that decided that their method of consultation was appropriate, these corrupt industry insiders. Yeah. So, devastating blow, but thankfully the resiliency of the community, Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, immediately going down to the river saying, hey, Enbridge, you got 30 days to shut down these pipelines. 30 days, Enbridge, and the reporter for CBC is like, so what you going to do after these 30 days? And Chief Meangan Henry said, well, the ball's in their court, you know. They got 30 days to shut them down. And the reporter said, is civil disobedience ruled out? And Meangan responded, Chief Meangan Henry responded, so something along the line that it's never not an option, but never didn't say like, yeah, this is what we're gonna do. I think he was sincere when he said the ball's in Enbridge's court, expecting Enbridge to shut it down. I'm not expecting Enbridge to shut down. I know Enbridge doesn't operate with any integrity or honor. The Chippewas of the Thames First Nation this entire time have been pushing through with integrity and honor. Through this system, through this corrupt system, fighting this corrupt decision.
And here is Chief Meangan Henry of the Chippewas of the Thames First Nation speaking to media and supporters after the Supreme Court decision.
I think the pipe ceremony was duly energizing, because we just had visits from our Migazay, our eagle, just now came over to look at what we were doing. We wanted to say these quotes, and they're very important. We, as a nation, Deshkanzibi, or Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, is disappointed today over the ruling that the Supreme Court had levied on our case. We know that our rights once again have been infringed upon based on the decision that came down from the Supreme Court. I know there's we had an air of happiness going into this because of how we thought this would turn out, but throughout the history of our people and all people around the world, things don't always turn out the way that we hope, but we can still see hope. Because when I look up in the sky and I see that eagle fly by, it gave me the hope that we can still accomplish things. And we still have work to do. So what I'd like to say to our Prime Minister of Canada at this time is that I feel ashamed that you would watch this process and not intervene, because you told Canada recently that the most important relationship were the indigenous peoples of this country. And as you sat back and watched our court case go for the last year, you've seen Enbridge deliver tar sands oil right through the litigation process. You watched as we had to generate funds to make it to the Supreme Court of Canada, and that is still an ongoing event that we need to contribute to. Mr. Trudeau, in your delivery of speeches, Aboriginal rights, you said were very important. Today, we see it the other way. You've denied our rights once again. You gave us a sense of hope, and then when it came down to the process that you put in place for us, and we reached that pinnacle, it was not what you said. We, as a nation, Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, would like to ask that you continue with this conversation with us, because we want to do things in a peaceful manner. We want to make sure that our nations are given the strength that they have, even in this political realm that we live in. But most important, I want to say to the President of Enbridge, Al Monaco, you've been at the helm for a while, and you've had discussions with many First Nations across Canada. And we ask very politely that you not deliver tar sands oil. And through our traditional territory, we still choose not to see it come through our territory. I'm going to ask that you, within 30 days, cease operations of tar sands oil through our traditional territory. We ask very calmly, we ask non-violently, that you consider that, please. We also want to turn to our nation, Deshkanzibi, Chippewas of the Thames. I know how you're feeling today. It's a very devastating effect that we felt when we heard the decision. I want us to keep level heads. I want us to play this in a way that is most efficient. We understand that sometimes when we revert to physical issues, sometimes it leads to dangers for our people. We can be strategic about how we take this next step. We can be strategic about how we deliver this to these young people who are watching us, because they're learning how we operate under these conditions, and we have to give them the strength to do that. I'd like to ask that Canada look at this once again and say together that we want Aboriginal treaty rights, inherent rights, our spiritual rights to be respected and to be delivered in a country that should be proud to call itself free. I'd like to ask all these people that gave up their hearts and soul today to be with us as we heard this decision. We know that there's a hurt in your soul and heart right now, but we can console together, and we'll work together, Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal, brothers and sisters of this land, the protectors, we'll work together even stronger. So I feel a bit rejuvenated now, because I know what my road has to be and how we can do it in a very respectful manner. And we will, because we've endured the things that they've put us through, and we're still here. Residential schools didn't take us away. We still have our spirit names, our clans, and our colors. And we still have our teachings. We have our elders. I want to thank you very, very dearly from my heart. So please take this day as a symbol that we need to do more work, and we will do the work, and we have to do the work together. Thank you very much for allowing us to be in the circle together, watched by our Creator, and the things we need to do in the next little while, we'll do with our utmost strength and heart. Miigwech.
After his speech, Chief Meingen Henry was asked several questions by the media. Here are those interactions.
You said that you'd like Enbridge to stop using the pipeline for oil sands crude in the next 30 days.
Yes.
What happens if they don't?
The ball's in their court. You know, they decide what happens. We just make a request, and we still feel that way, that tar sands is too dangerous all across this whole pipeline from Sarnia to Montreal. And it's just a request that we have for them, and how they respond to it, that's up to them.
And how confident are you that they will listen to your people if they haven't listened in the past.
I'm not going to put words in their mouth. I'm just going to say that we've made a request of them, and maybe they've seen some reaction that we have, and I think it's probably better for them to make that call.
How did you feel this morning when you found out about the decision?
Two things. Based on our history with courts, sometimes there's a win, sometimes there's not. But this time, I was at least prepared for either way. I was hopeful, of course, for a win in this case, and I really want to say Chief Wetch to Clyde River for their part of it. But for our case, very disappointed at the decision.
Do you think you asked your people to keep strength as they go forward in the next 30 days and in the next little while? What can you address them a little bit more for us?
Well, our people, we're resilient. As Del, you know, watched throughout his time, and Leslie through her time, and all the people that were leaders in our community watched us go through devastation, poverty, and the likes of that. We're resilient. We will maintain our strength. We'll get through this. And our people, as you see in that little boy sing, has what it takes to do that. That song, that name, that language is going to give him the strength to endure even something like this. So I think my community, Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, we cling hold to that beautifulness of being an Anishinaabe, and that's what's going to get us through.
Did you consider some kind of civil disobedience or that kind of action?
Every challenge comes with those questions, and at some point you might have to talk about that. When you reach the highest level of court, and where else do you go on an issue that's even higher than that, like our spiritual responsibility to the land? Well, then I think we have to consider that at some point.
Can you just tell us a little bit about today's ceremony, what we're doing out here?
Well, it was important that we come down to the river because years ago when our people were here and giving prayers to our Creator, they said that they would protect that water and they would do everything they have. So we need to renew that today. We were caught in a situation where we heard something that was quite devastating, so we had to come down and renew those vows to the river, and that's what we did with the pipe ceremony.
Yeah, maybe if and the court costs. That's another slap is this court cost. Another $200,000 in court costs or whatever Enbridge is going to say they cost. How about money for Chippewas of the Thames for having a pipeline run through their land for the last 45 years without any compensation? I mean, the pipeline, when it first went in, it didn't have permission, and it broke the treaty when it was installed. And it's continually, it being there is a continual disruption, and it's breaking the treaty. It's contravening the treaty's agreements. And where's the money to Chippewas of the Thames? They have to give Enbridge another $250,000? They're saying their court costs are up around $600,000 now, including the federal court and everything right through. And Enbridge is they're going to be at $250,000 or more. So this is, we'll see what happens. We'll keep you updated. Hopefully we can get an interview with Chief Meehan Henry on the situation in the coming weeks as the 30 days approaches, to maybe to see what's up. I think people should be putting pressure right now on Enbridge, on the Canadian government, on the Liberal government in Canada, Justin Trudeau's Liberal government, on their local MPs, on Enbridge, on wherever they can put pressure. I think people should be putting pressure and showing their solidarity with Chippewas of the Thames First Nation through action and demonstration and protests and pickets and getting and lobbying and stopping this clear violation of treaty, clear violation of Indigenous rights. Anytime they say reconciliation, the government says reconciliation and oh, we're going through this process of reconciliation. No, they're not. This is reconciliation for the colonizer. This isn't reconciliation for the Indigenous populations on Turtle Island. This is reconciliation for the settler colonial capitalist state of Canada. And don't fall for it. This is not what reconciliation is. It just isn't, and it shouldn't be considered so. And it's shameful, the behavior of the Canadian government around all of this, including this case specifically, where it's been in the courts for months. Enbridge has been making money off the pipeline. Trudeau just, you know, not stepping in at all. He doesn't want new relationships. He wants certainty for the for the corporations. That's what they're looking for. That's what the neoliberal governments are looking for. All of them. And I haven't heard otherwise from the NDP that they're not going to be a neoliberal government. So until I hear that, I'm going to keep going with all of them. Check out ChippewaSolidarity.org. There's a donate page. Huh? Donate page. Check out the donate page for this. And if you got some simoleons, drop them on to Chippewas of the Thames First Nation, because they need to continue to build a fund that they can continue to fight this. It's shocking that how the decision came down. On Twitter, Laurel L. Russworm wrote, "Supreme Court of Canada's Line 9 decision is shocking. Consultation doesn't mean the king tells you what he's going to do." That's what happened here. I really like that one. And it's shocking, is all I can say. Chippewas Line 9 on Twitter for their Twitter feed. My Twitter feed has been chocked full of Chippewas of the Thames, hashtag SCC and hashtag Line 9, of course. My Twitter's Dan Keller. And be ready. And there's lots of other pipelines that should be countered as well. Line 10, Line 11, Line 7, Line 8. Those are all just in this area. They all, most of them, cross the Grand River watershed or the Thames River watershed, or any of the other watersheds that that flow down to the Great Lakes. These dangerous pipelines, they leak. They constantly leak. They corrode from the toxic goo that's being shipped through them from the tar sands, from the back in shale oil fields, the fracking fields, and Enbridge is just, they're just going until what, you know, like, we know we need to stop taking it out of the ground. And we need to stop it. We need to stop taking it out of the ground. And how else do we stop taking it out of the ground other than stopping it, taking it out of the ground? I mean, economically, you know, the economics of it seem to be shutting it down through shutting down the oil and gas industry. But it's taking a really, really long time, and I don't know ecologically if it can keep going, plus all the damage that's going to be done, not just through climate change, but through the actual the developments around it, the pipelines, the spills, the actual tar sands themselves. Yeah. Dan Keller here on AWOL Radio. We're going to go to a tune, the actual Rebel Spell version of Last Run. We'll be right back. AWOL Radio here. Thanks for joining us on CKMS 102.7 FM on the FM dial. RadioWaterloo.ca on the web. And if you're using Rogers Cable, we're on 946. And it's somewhat relatedly from that last talk about pipelines. We acted from our hearts. Activists in Iowa admit to repeatedly sabotaging the Dakota Access Pipeline. And here is that interview.
Now, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Iowa, where two Catholic workers have revealed they secretly carried out multiple acts of sabotage and arson in recent months in order to stop construction of the controversial $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. Jessica Resnicek and Ruby Montoya said that on Election Day last year, they set fire to five pieces of heavy machinery being used to construct the pipeline. The two then taught themselves how to destroy empty pipeline valves and moved up and down the pipeline's length, destroying the valves and delaying construction for weeks. They say their actions were inspired by the anti-nuclear plowshares movement, which used nonviolent direct action to target nuclear warheads and military installations. On Monday, they spoke outside the Iowa Utilities Board office. This begins with Jessica Resnicek.
We are speaking publicly to empower others to act boldly, with purity of heart, to dismantle the infrastructures which deny us our rights to water, land, and liberty. We as civilians have seen the repeated failures of the government, and it is our duty to act with responsibility and integrity, risking our own liberty for the sovereignty of us all.
Some may view these actions as violent, but be not mistaken. We acted from our hearts and never threatened human life nor personal property. What we did do was fight a private corporation that has run rampantly across our country, seizing land and polluting our nation's water supply.
And that was Ruby Montoya, along with Jessica Resnicek, speaking Monday. After delivering their statement, the two used a hammer and crowbar to try to pull off the letters of the Iowa Utilities Board sign in protest of its recent decision to reject a lawsuit by environmental groups to revoke the pipeline's state permit and force it to shut down. The women were arrested and jailed overnight for destroying the sign and are now facing possible arrest at any time for committing multiple acts of sabotage. I spoke to Jessica Resnicek and Ruby Montoya earlier this week. I began by asking Ruby to talk about what they did and why they're coming forward now.
So on an election night, we went to a DAPL easement site in Buena Vista County, and we saw over six or seven pieces of heavy machinery there, and we went with our supplies, and we filled these coffee canisters up with gasoline and oil. We placed those coffee canisters on the inside of the cabs of these heavy machinery on the seats, and we pierced those coffee canisters so that the flammable liquids would spread. We then lit matches and in efforts to make those machines obsolete. We acted after having exhausted all other avenues of political process and resistance to this petroleum pipeline that, to my knowledge, is the largest in the United States as far as the capacity that it is able to carry the oil.
Jessica Resnicek, how did you know where this pipeline was?
Well, I knew exactly where this pipeline was because it's not more than 15 miles from this studio. It runs right here through the county I was born in, Polk County, Iowa. I definitely took a lot of inspiration from what I saw up at Standing Rock, but Iowa is impacted greatly by this, and my home city's drinking water is to be destroyed when this pipeline breaks. And so it's not a matter of having to find it. It's right. It found me.
So the investigation into the damage to the pipeline has been ongoing. But apparently the authorities did not have leads into who committed these acts of sabotage. So, Jessica, why did you decide, you and Ruby, decide to come forward on Monday?
Well, I guess one of the main reasons is Ruby and I felt very disheartened by the fact that oil is now flowing through the pipeline. Obviously, we cannot pierce through empty valves anymore. They are not empty. We halted construction up and down the line for several weeks, turning into months. And we're now at the phase where we have to deal with the reality that this pipeline, that we failed, as resistance here in Iowa goes. And now oil's flowing through it, and there's really nothing more to do now than come forward and let the public know that, and continue this public discourse about what that means, where we're heading, and the consequences of it.
Ruby, you talked about beginning this action of sabotage on election night. Why the significance of this day, election day, and then talk about what happened in the ensuing weeks, what exactly you did?
Well, election day, it was very serendipitous. It just happened by coincidence. I remember the next day we were with the Mississippi Stand caravan, and other comrades had crawled into the Dakota Access Pipeline and occupied it for over 15 hours at least. So I remember showing up there at the Des Moines River boring site and still being elated by the action that we took the previous night, because we knew that through the actions of Mississippi Stand, they had halted the boring process temporarily, and through the actions that Jessica and I took the evening prior, we had also halted construction temporarily. So that felt really great, and we saw the effectiveness of these peaceful means to take fire and other materials to these empty structures of metal to disable them so that they could not continue their process of destruction. As time went on, we saw that construction continued, and that pipe was being put into the ground, and so our only viable means was to somehow obstruct this pipe. And that material is made of steel, 5/8 inch steel, and we had to figure out something that would melt it or somehow make it obsolete. So we began to look for things that would cut through that amount of steel, and that turned out to be oxygen and acetylene, which burns at a like over 2,000 degrees, and that melts steel. So after acquiring that knowledge, we proceeded and found many empty valves. All of the valves were empty. And we began first in Mahaska County, Iowa, piercing through a valve there. And later we continued until we ran out of supplies, hitting multiple valve sites.
So what are the significance of these valves? What do they do?
They are access points to shut off the flow of oil. So I know that that occurred with a group up in the tar sands area of Alberta, Canada. So you can physically shut these valves off if there is oil in them, but since there was not oil in them, this is the part of the pipeline that is exposed. The rest is underground and underneath our waterways. So with this steel exposed, instead of having to operate a bulldozer and try to dig it up, it was easier to find these exposed valves and cut underneath the seams of these valves, because these valves have seams. And if you cut underneath the seams, it's a lot more effective in terms of them having to dig it up further and costing them more money and more time and pushing back that completion date until our goal was for them to exhaust their financial means so that they would stop with this pipeline.
Now, Jessica Reznicek, there are many who would say that destroying private property like this is violence. Your response to this?
I completely disagree. I think that the oil being taken out of the ground and the machinery that does it and the infrastructure which supports it, this is violent. These tools and these mechanisms that industry and corporate power and government power have all colluded together to create. This is destructive. This is violent, and it needs to be stopped. And we never at all threatened human life. We're acting in an effort to save human life, to save our planet, to save our resources. And nothing at any point was ever done by Ruby nor I and anything outside of peaceful, deliberate and steady loving hands.
Can you explain what Plowshares actions are? For those who don't know, you're both Catholic workers, Jessica and Ruby, living at the Catholic Worker House in Des Moines. Can you explain what the Catholic Worker movement is all about?
So we have a rich tradition started by Dorothy Day in the 1930s. And we have a rich tradition both in assisting underprivileged people in our communities via soup kitchens, hospitality, shelters for homeless people who we live with in our communities. And we also have, on the flip side of that, we also recognize the resistance that is needed to help bring underprivileged people back up to the same level as the people who are taking the money from them. In essence, Ruby and I focus on the resistance aspect here in the Des Moines Catholic Worker, and we have followed suit, and I believe that we're inspired by Mr. Phil Berrigan. The house that we live in is named after, and we do understand the need to dismantle infrastructure when it poses a threat to human life and liberty.
So let me talk about and ask you about that tradition of the Berrigan brothers, of Father Dan Berrigan and Philip Berrigan, who helped launch the international anti-nuclear Plowshares movement. Father Dan and seven others poured blood and hammered on warheads at a GE nuclear missile plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, in 1980. I asked Father Dan Berrigan about this during an interview I did with him around, a decade ago.
We went in with the workers at the changing of the shift and found there was really no security worth talking about. Very easy entrance. In about 3 minutes, we were looking at doomsday. The weapon was before us. It was an unarmed warhead about to be shipped to Amarillo, Texas for its payload. So it was a harmless weapon as of that moment. And we cracked the weapon. It was very fragile. It was made to withstand the heat of reentry into the atmosphere from outer space. So it was like eggshell, really. And we had taken as our motto the great statement of Isaiah 2, they shall beat their swords into plowshares. So we did it, poured our blood around it, and stood in a circle, I think, reciting the Lord's Prayer until Armageddon arrived, as we expected.
And, of course, Father Dan Berrigan and his brother Philip Berrigan and others, the Catonsville Nine in 1968, burned the draft files of people in Catonsville, Maryland, using napalm that was used in Vietnam. Do you consider this a Plowshares action?
It has been characterized by Ruby and I as what we call a rolling Plowshares, yes. An extended Plowshares action, yes.
At the end of your statement on Monday, and you were standing in front of Iowa Utilities Board office, can you explain its significance and why you then turned around and started ripping off the metal letters from that sign as the police moved in to arrest you?
The Iowa Utilities Board here in Iowa granted the Dakota Access LLC permits using eminent domain as a public utility for this pipeline. So the company was allowed by the Iowa Utilities Board to come and seize land from farmers to put this petroleum pipeline underneath their fields. So the Iowa Utilities Board here in Iowa was key because Dakota Access Pipeline and Energy Transfer Partners were able to sidestep the legal requirement of an environmental impact statement. So each state had its governing body to either grant or deny these permits to build this pipeline. And here in Iowa, that was the Iowa Utilities Board. And it was granted under the guise, under the lie of a public utility. And this past Friday, they released another decision, yet again doing the wrong thing, and ruling in favor of the Dakota Access Pipeline and Energy Transfer Partners. So that's why we were there. There have been many protests, vigils, hunger strikes in front of that building with no response, public commentary hearings with no response from this board. Jerry Hooser, who's the head of this board, it's a three-person board, she's actually under investigation for corruption. And so the list goes on and on as to why the Iowa Utilities Board is culpable in the allowance of the Dakota Access Pipeline to come through Iowa. So we couldn't have picked a better place to release our statement. And with trying to remove all of the letters from the Iowa Utilities Board, we don't feel that they represent Iowans, or nor do they have their best interests in mind. Clearly, time and time again, they are siding with these oil companies because of corruption.
And Ruby, overall, the Dakota Access Pipeline, what it means to you? Did you and Jessica go to the resistance camps at the time of the last year during the height of the resistance?
I actually met Jessica on the Mississippi River. Prior to that, I was a preschool teacher in Boulder, Colorado, and I found out about the Dakota Access Pipeline. I read about what they were intending to do to put these dirty petroleum pipes underneath our major waterways here in the United States, and I was aghast by their intentions. So I quit my job, and I went to Standing Rock, and I was greatly comforted by the amount of people that were there, the amount of helping hands, ready to do resistance work and community work. And I was following the Dakota Access Pipeline so closely that I found out about Jessica Resnicek starting an encampment on the Mississippi River bore site. And I went there because I knew that there were not a lot of people there.
Jessica, how did you get involved with the Catholic worker movement?
I met the Catholic workers. They were here in Des Moines, when they were at the forefront of the local Occupy movement happening here at the Iowa State Capitol. Originally, I quit college. I dropped out of college and went to Zuccotti Park to Occupy in New York. Received a call from a close cousin of mine here in Des Moines and said, hey, they're occupying Des Moines right now. Was something like 30-some people just got arrested yesterday. And so I came back to Des Moines and got plugged in to all of the organizing that was going on here around the caucuses at the time. There was a lot happening here. And time and time again, I looked at who were the key leadership roles in that movement, although there was a leaderless movement, I would say. It was the Catholic workers, and I thought, I should really check these folks out. And I started, and I came, started volunteering at the house. We have a soup kitchen that's open 5 days a week, and began to volunteer 5 days a week, moved in, and really, it's been quite the journey ever since.
So at this point, you have not been charged with anything but pulling off the letters of the sign where you were on Monday when you made your statement.
That is correct, yeah.
That is correct. However, while we were incarcerated overnight for that criminal mischief charge, we did have federal agents pull us out of ourselves individually, one at a time. And to address the statement, Ruby and I, of course, said that we did not want to cooperate or communicate with them, and we were then released back into ourselves. They have let us know that they are aware.
That was Jessica Resnicek and Ruby Montoya, two Catholic worker activists who admitted earlier this week to carrying out multiple acts of sabotage against sections of the Dakota Access Pipeline that were under construction in Iowa. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
That's some inspiring stuff right there. Salute. Salute to Ruby and Jessica on their actions, on their determined actions against a pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, using torches, blowtorches, oxyacetylene blowtorches to punch holes in valve sites and delaying construction for weeks and months on end in their actions of destroying the infrastructure. What a great interview as well. They spoke so clearly and intentionally, knowing exactly what they were doing, in a peaceful manner of defending the earth and ensuring we have a future to look forward to, or working to lessen how bad it's going to get. Because let's not fool ourselves. It's going to get bad. We're not stopping climate change anytime soon. We're hitting 2, 3, 4 degrees. You know, we'll see what geoengineering can do to slow that down. But boy, oh boy. Great work, Jessica Resnicek and Ruby Montoya. Viva la Revolution. AWOL Radio here on CKMS 102.7 FM. Check us out on RadioWaterloo.ca. Check out AWOL Radio on GrandRiverMC.ca. We have lots of old shows on the Rabble Podcast Network as well, but no new shows. We're done. Is that enough? A little late. See you later.